Episode 201 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. Something you talk about is overcoming yourself and having to surrender to the market and know that you truly have an edge. You know, I've heard you speak about this. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm told, and I've had several kind of evaluations done, but I'm told I have a particularly good psychological makeup for trading. What that specifically is, I don't quite know. But I just don't care about losing money. It sounds strange. I just don't care about losing money. Many years ago when we were managing money, I remember doing a talk to a whole bunch of high net worth individuals that were brought together by a bank that was allocating money to us. And one of these individuals walked up to me afterwards and said, "I can't possibly give you money. You clearly don't give a damn about my money." So I sort of do, but you know, you've got to be detached from it. And I think that's an important thing, to be completely detached as you can from the money, because at the end of the day, so much of the emotional decision-making that takes place is surrounded by the money involved. I think we just put so much emphasis on the money, which is ironic because one of the things we want to do when we get into trading is make money. But I think the more you can detach yourself from that, and I think, you know, you hear this old saying that only trade with money you can afford to lose. My feeling with that is that's detachment, complete detachment. You know, here's $50,000 and I don't care if that goes and I don't care if I lose that. And if you can truly be in that position, then I think you'll be a lot more successful, because I know that when there are decisions to be made based on emotion, usually you'll make the wrong decision. Let me give you a recent example about being completely detached from it. When President Trump was elected, that night he was elected, I was 100% long in two of my US equity portfolios, and I'm sitting here and I can see the S&P was down 100 handles in the night session. And it was more like it's going to be an interesting day tomorrow. And I woke up in the morning, and then we were up that day. We were up 150 points or something ridiculous. And it's like, whew, there you go. If I'd been emotional about it, you know, I would have gone in there and I couldn't have got out of my stock positions, but I could have hedged. And in fact, I got an email from a client saying, you know, if I wasn't trading systematically, I would have been getting out of those positions and woken up today and I would have lost all that money. So I think if you can really ignore the money, and that's a very difficult thing to do, it takes a lot of training, but if you can really detach from the money, you'll then become a lot less emotional, and I think you'll become a much better trader.
I want to talk a little bit about cryptos. How much interest have you seen in the futures industry trying to get involved with crypto assets and blockchain technology?
Wow, a ton. I mean, we've been telling clients for a couple of years now that this is what we're seeing, and you know, on the crypto side at least, hearing all over the place, and that if they didn't have a playbook for crypto or a roadmap, that they should get on that, because we saw it coming, and most of our clients wholeheartedly agreed and have some type of strategy in place. You know, I think it's been a fantastic development for traders. Certainly they like the volatility, the speculative nature of it, but just, you know, more on a professional level, having gone to so many conferences over the years, you start to pick up on the vibe, and there wasn't a lot of optimism in the traditional conferences that I went to, securities industry, futures industry, and the options folks. I mean, you know, it was kind of the same thing. Let's talk about some regulation, what new products might work, what regions of the globe are going to be hot, whatever, whatever. But it was, I won't quite say it was a malaise, but it felt like the industry was going through the motions. In walks crypto, and all of a sudden people are passionate. They are, you know, tirelessly trying to figure it out. And in that regard, it's been fun, because we have clients active in crypto. And even at 3 points, we have a very modest coin holding. And we did that mostly just so that we would understand the process by which you would need to do it and to trade it and to be a really an authentic member of the crypto community.
It's amazing, the growth, isn't it, Drew? I mean, for all the doubters out there, when you hear it from Drew, someone who works with top people and companies in the futures and financial industry, and you hear it from you say that it's been huge, and how everybody seems to want a piece of this, it says a lot.
Yeah, it's been fun kind of watching the more established players kind of methodically and what I would say is very slowly get involved, because I'm 15 or so years into my career. I remember when the futures industry was considered a little bit of the gunslingers, the Wild West, and New York was really the buttoned up trading community. And then when the futures listed on Bitcoin, that was a moment of huge credibility for that industry. And I just thought, well, it was a little ironic that it's the futures gals and boys that are providing the credibility for crypto, when for years, futures themselves lacked credibility.
I put a tweet out the other day, and it got a good response. And I said, day trader doesn't mean you have to trade every day. I take a lot of time off, especially after good runs. And I said, a lot of times traders will have their worst runs after their best runs. And once I get on a good run and I give back roughly 20%, I take some time off. I said, I'm here to make money, not just to trade. And I wanted to talk to you about this, Q. You've been in the industry longer than me. I have a lot of respect for you and your trading. So I wanted to know what you think about this. You know, do you notice in your trading, after you go on a good run and you start to give some money back, that it benefits you to take time off? Do you ever take time off? And when I say time off, I know a lot of people are like, well, what does he do? Does he go golfing? Well, I do a lot of that. And we can joke about that a lot, but I do that in the afternoons. But I watch the market every day, even when I'm taking time off. I just feel it's important as a trader that, you know, I spent all those years, I had the work ethic where I watched the market from the minute I woke up to the minute I went to bed. And even in the middle of the night when I'd wake up, I'd be looking at it on my phone. And that work ethic didn't really mean I was making more money. I felt that I needed to be able to not be in position, step back, learn patience, get a better perspective. So when I started to struggle, to be able to allow myself the time to figure it out and come back. And really, I've learned that by not trading at times has really been beneficial to me in my growth in longevity. So I just want to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I take a lot of time off, to be honest. And, you know, my thoughts are is that, you know, if I'm on a wave, you can't get me away from the board. I mean, I just killed it in 1988. I mean, I was just so on the market. But what I did after that was I took 4 months off and went to Europe. And had just a fabulous time. And, you know, Europe, Greece, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. It was a great time. You know, my side passions, of course, as you know, are galaxies, which I read a great deal about. And I love ancient history. So I've been to pretty much all the major ancient history sites on the planet. And you know, that's what I like to do to get away. And frankly, that's why I work so hard, you know, making this money in the wheat pit so I can do stuff like that. As far as, you know, getting on runs and off runs, I always had a rule that if the first three trades were bad, I closed my book, gave my cards to my clerk, went down to Sears and just drank all day. And, you know, my theory is that a bar bill is much cheaper than a big hickey from, you know, trying to fight the markets. And, you know, when Sybil just changed her mind on occasion, and, you know, just got to figure out what she's thinking. Because if you fight her, you're going to end up, you know, with a margin call. And, you know, to be honest, you know, like in 1986, I killed it again. And I took 6 weeks off, went to Greece. So I spent 6 weeks in Greece. I had a big KC July Sep on at the time. I mean, nearly limit position. And I was sitting in Athens drinking coffee in the Syntagma Square, and all of a sudden Chernobyl blew up. And we just went to the moon. I made a fortune just sitting in Athens drinking coffee. So, you know, it's one of those things where I'd love to take time off. You know, trading is my life. My life is not trading. You know, it's how I make my living. And, you know, you get to meet some interesting people. But, no, I totally agree with you. You're going to burn out because, you know, Sybil will kill you, believe me. And, you know, when you see what's happening in the bond market, stock market this year, try to fight that thing. You know, you're going to get some, going to take a few years off your life. So I totally agree with that.
Yeah, no, thanks for that insight, Q. And, you know, I just look back at my career. I'm coming up on 20 years that I've been trading independently, over 20 years in the industry. And I've learned so much when I've been able to step back that it's allowed me to be in the industry this long. And I've learned so much about myself and my trading. And I really do believe that I've gained so much patience and better perspective about my strategy when I just sit back and watch it. And I said the other day in a Periscope, I said, if you can't afford to take one day off, then you should be taking a week off and you're probably underfunded, you know, because I believe that you need to be able to watch the market. Just because you're not actively in a position every day doesn't mean you're not trading. You could actually be watching and in your mind, you know, tweaking your strategy, understanding the flows of the market. That's just my two cents. You know, I feel strongly about that. So,
yeah, well, I totally agree. I mean, back in, you know, 1985, 86, you know, I came out of the box on like the first day, you know, red May wheat was on the board. I did a huge Dees Marsh May butterfly with the Koreans, made a fortune on it, got cocky. About 2-3 months after I took that off, I got into a huge old crop, new crop spread the wrong way, had China running up my you know what, nearly got taken out. I mean, I nearly was out of the board of trade on that one. And then I took 5-6 weeks off, came back and made a fortune in the March 1986 wheat delivery. So it's just one of those things where you've got to get out, you've got to clear the mind and, you know, see what the flow is. Because, you know, as a spread trader, I'm much more into the big picture of, you know, what's going on in politics, what's going on in the markets, the spreads, the intermarkets, and everything else. I mean, a lot of the day traders that I see are way too focused on the bark of the trees and miss the whole forest. And, you know, that's what spreaders have to do is to observe the forest and anticipate what's coming. And, you know, the what's going on in the tree doesn't really matter. It's just noise to us. So, but what that allows me to do is to, you know, step back. I would actually go, you know, to Greece or to, you know, Easter Island, I went with a big position on just because I was comfortable where I was at. It didn't matter what happened, as long as it wasn't old crop, new crop wheat. But, you know, that's how I always traded. And, you know, I mean, I've been to places where I can't even see what the markets were doing for like 8 days in a row. So it's, you know, that's a real character builder if you're glued to your screen.
I want to talk a little bit about the current markets because this is where we go from having a strategy that has worked for us and then all of a sudden volatility changes, right? It can get slower, it can get busier. And all of a sudden what was once working to where you finally picked that one strategy all of a sudden isn't, or it's harder to execute. So I know that you work with a lot of newer traders. Mm-hmm. And once you make money doing something and the market changes, it's hard to adapt. So how are you helping traders adapt to these changing environments?
Okay, this is an excellent question. And every time somebody asks me this, I'm reminded of the tech boom and all those guys in the NASDAQ pit that just basically traded buy side only for so many years. And when the market state changed, they didn't. Many of them lost what they had made, and they couldn't figure out why. And again, it starts very basic, Anthony. There are, if you really look at it, there's two basic market states: ranging or balancing, consolidating, chopping, whatever you want to call it, and trending. So when you have a market that you are successful in that is ranging, and you're basically, let's say, reversion trading. Okay, you're up near the highs, you're short. Gets near the mean, you get out. Gets near the low, you buy. Gets near the mean, you get out. This is one trading strategy for a range type trade. As soon as that range type trade fails and a new market state ensues, let's say we go from ranging to trending, it's a different market. It's a different strategy. So you need to start thinking, okay, I'm recognizing that this market is in this particular market state. I'm going to be using this strategy. As soon as I recognize that the market state may or has changed, I have to change the strategy. Now, some people are going to tell me I'm crazy because, you know, we all need one strategy that's going to work for us forever, but that doesn't exist. That's the holy grail that everybody's searching for and nobody has found yet. So when the market changes, let's say we go into an extremely volatile period of time, I may suggest to some of my newer traders, hey, watch and learn. Anthony, you and I have been through, you know, several corrections in our trading career. And do I have a solid strategy that's going to consistently make me money in an extremely volatile market? Not necessarily. The moves are bigger, wider, stronger, wilder. If you're going to be engaging in these volatile markets, you're going to have to recognize two things. Yeah, your opportunities are great, but your risk is greatly expanded as well. So it's very flashy. Everybody wants to get in and make a whole bunch of money in these volatile markets. Very few people, I think, actually have the skills to be able to do so consistently. I think it's a lot of it might be, you know, just luck. If you're not a professional trader, you're going to be increasing your risk. And if you're not keeping the math on your side, in other words, if you're increasing your risk, you need big wins. You need to hold those big win opportunities in order to consistently profit in this. These markets, to me, Anthony, are very difficult. I don't like to engage in wild days. I'll find ways to make profits over time, and you know, for me, I'm largely watching, except for, you know, longer investment type opportunities. You know, if we get a big down move or a big down cycle in the stocks, I always view those as buying opportunities. But as far as day traders are concerned, it's more of a gamble and very difficult to put together a solid strategy for, in my opinion. I don't know, you know, maybe others are going to disagree, but it lends towards emotional, flashy, lemming type trading.
Execution is everything.
Absolutely.
And if you know your strategy, then you know your strengths and you know your weaknesses. So when a certain type of market comes into play, you know when to be aggressive and when to be less aggressive. One of the things that I've taught myself is know when to be big, and know when to be small, and know when not to trade. That goes back to understanding my strategy. If things are lining up, the market doesn't have to be busy to make a lot of money. My best days were not days where the market had moves like we've seen over the last month or two. I mean, I've had good days during those times too, but those winners took care of themselves. But the days that the market was just maybe in a regular trading range, I've had some of my best days, career days, because I was executing on point and the market was responding to my strategy. Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000 and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. Everywhere that there's media, they're talking about the effects of the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement. So I'm really curious to hear what you guys think about this. And I want to know, and we're going to start with you today, Sam, what is the actual market impact of Iranian sanction assessments of how much crude oil will be off the market, and when will it affect the curve?
So if we look at the previous era of sanctions, there was about 1 million barrels a day that was removed from the market, at least from Iran. And back then, you had the international community behind it. So you had the UN sanctions on Iran because of the nuclear story. Now, the situation is a bit different. And the one who's driving this, of course, is the United States without the United Nations. So the impact of it might not be as large. However, the U.S. has some angles which they're going to try, and that is to put pressure on the insurance companies and the companies that deal with the actual freight and any partners who work with the Iranian oil production. Now, how much will be removed from the market from Iran's perspective? I wouldn't say it's going to be anywhere near 1 million barrels a day. I would say it's probably a third to half at very most. And there are now, what's happened since last time is that if you look at China, their intake of crude oil has just skyrocketed since then. If we look at a five-year period, so in the latest imports report, there was something like 9.5 or 9.6 million barrels per day in intake. So that means that they are the number one crude oil importer in the world. And they bring in every single grade under the sun from all corners of the world. And so if they now get a whiff from Iran that there is a discount happening, they will take more oil from Iran just for that reason. And it's not just because it fits them geopolitically because they have a stance against the United States just as Russia does, but also because it's a golden opportunity given the fact that oil prices are very high right now. And Iran has published its discount list for June. And it shows that they are offering $6 discount in the West, and eventually it will be even better for the East. So that's what's going on with Iran. I don't believe it'll be more than 300,000 to 500,000 barrels at most.
Pat, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm pretty much on the same page. You know, I looked at some of the assessments of various different analysts as, you know, we tried to figure out when these things were going to kick in. But the estimates are, you know, on the low end between 100 to 200,000. I think that's kind of an outlier. But most of the assessments are about a half a million barrels a day. So, you know, it could even be a little bit less than that. Some have made it even larger. And this is, I'm talking about 2018 right now. And so we're thinking that the front end of the curve should be a little bit under pressure, which is what is happening in the market right now. The front end of the curve should be slightly weaker. And then we'll start to see really the market responding, say, fourth quarter. And so, you know, today, actually, we went into contango in the first 2 months of WTI. So, yeah, I basically, agree with Sam. And, one point is that the U.S., Treasury has what they call wind down periods. It's a 90-day period and a 180-day period. In the first 90 days, there'll be a series of things that the U.S. will, put sanctions on, which are, Iranian trading of metals and different products and autos and some ability to use capital markets to float their debt. And then by 180 days, the U.S. is pretty much asking that, our partners wind down their activities with Iran. And, the kind of hard edge to all of this is that there's the possibility, which the assessment of how much of a loss of production there will be is to some extent a function of, will the U.S. slap secondary sanctions on people who are trading with Iran during that period.
Now, let's talk a little bit. I want to start with you, Kev. Your latest post was very interesting to me. And I always love how you put these things out there that I didn't know about. And then, gets me thinking. And the latest one was called the Fed model. And it was discussing interest rates versus some levels in the S&P. And this is right in my backyard, because that's what I basically trade all the time is, I'm trading a lot of the short end of the curve and I trade the S&P. Talk to us a little bit about this post and why you decided to write it.
Well, I'd always kind of wondered what was the Fed model. You'd heard it talked about, and it was basically a way of valuing stocks versus interest rates. And but where did it come from? Why was it called the Fed model? And so I kind of did a little bit of research and dug it up. And it started in 1997 in a Humphrey Hawkins testimony by Alan Greenspan, where he commented on the earnings yield of the S&P 500, meaning the earnings per share divided by the price of the actual index to get a yield versus the interest rate. And he mentioned it in his testimony. And after that, Ed Yardini, who at the time was with Deutsche Morgan Grenfeld, actually dubbed it the Fed model based upon the fact that it was mentioned here. It actually was never officially endorsed by the Federal Reserve. And I think that in subsequent years, they mentioned it just briefly, but it wasn't something that was actually charted and basically followed by the Fed. But it still was something that Wall Street embraced and started to watch. And the reason is if you think about it, stocks should be correlated to the long-term interest rate of the discount rate. And they should go together. And if we all know, if interest rates go down, then stocks should go up. In terms, and especially when you look at it on a yield basis in terms of earnings versus the actual underlying index level. But one of the things that Greenspan noted in 1997 was the fact that stocks had actually risen more than the earning or than the interest rates had fallen. And so what I did was I actually went and created the Fed model and kind of went and looked at it from the period of 1982 to 2018. And what I noticed was that there was a period from the first 20 years where the earnings yield, meaning that the level upon which stocks traded versus their earnings, was actually lower than the 10-year interest rate. Then in 2002, it flipped, and actually stocks traded higher relative to the actual interest rate. And I thought about why that might be and kind of went through it in my mind, and I realized that the model was kind of flawed. It might work fine when interest rates are 5, 4, or maybe even 3.5, but as interest rates go closer and closer to zero, if you kind of stop and think about it, the price that you're willing to pay for the actual stock indexes would approach infinity as that interest rate approaches zero. And then if you went into a state like a situation whereas in Europe where you actually have negative rates, it breaks down completely and it just can't be done. So you realize that the Fed model, maybe it worked when the rates were 4 or 5, but as rates went lower, it broke down. Now, there's lots of other reasons that people kind of postulate why it doesn't work. Some people argue that you should use corporate rates. Other people argue that interest rates are a nominal kind of instrument that don't protect against inflation, whereas stocks are a real asset. And I don't really have any answers. I just thought it was really interesting to look at these two periods and to realize that there was definitely a distinct period where stocks traded rich to interest rates, and now almost the opposite, where interest rates are more expensive, meaning like bonds are a higher price relative to stocks. It's like bonds have gone down in yield, up in price, and stocks almost don't believe that that's the correct level. That's almost my interpretation.
All right, great stuff. I want to move on and talk a little bit about crude oil here. Tone, I have to give you props. Last time you were on the show, I asked you what your favorite trade was, and you told me long crude oil. You talked to us about how you got into the trade. You talked to us through the execution and how you were looking to trail and try and stay long it. So it's been quite some time since we did speak about you getting into that trade. After reading your letter, you're still bullish crude oil. I believe you're still in the trade. So talk to us about how you're executing your trade and your thoughts on crude oil going forward.
Sure. I tell you, I've been keeping my eye on Khalid Al-Fali, who is the Saudi oil minister. And he is, an outspoken leader of OPEC, and he has been saying the entire time that their goal is to cut the U.S. Excess supply down. The way he was going to do that is with OPEC production cuts. If you believed in his narrative and you watched the physical side of the oil market tighten, meaning watch the 1 year spread, calendar spreads tighten, watch the curve go more backwardated, you were able to stay in the oil trade with no problem. We got oil up into the 50s, and the spec position got pretty large. And the DMARC traders came out and said, okay, we've got sequential 9s and 13s and crude oil is going to turn over again. But they really weren't watching the underlying dynamics, which were massive growth in U.S. crude exports. And that was a real big lever for me to see exports growing, to seeing, crude values at various different locations around the country, not just WTI, rallying in price due to foreign demand, from China, from India, et cetera. And that was just able to get, I was able to stay with the narrative, so that was really just staying in this uptrend in the crude oil market and in USO that I think we talked about trading. I was probably somewhere around, 11 or 12 bucks back then, or somewhere between 10 and 12. And now we're up at 14 and a half. And that if you look at the USO chart, which you and I probably have a lot of technical analysis background together, the chart, the trend is pretty as a picture. And when you look at the USO chart and you need some confidence to stay long at the highs, what I continue to do is look at the DC crude oil chart and see that that spread hasn't backed off at all. So you're seeing the calendar spread staying, not only stay remain tight, but remained in an uptrend even tighter. And that's when I started drilling down into a couple of more equities that I thought would really get a good bang for their buck if we had an ascending crude oil and gasoline price. So if you stayed with, the Khalid Al-Fali narrative, if you followed Mohammed bin Salman and his trip to 60 Minutes and his tour around the United States, he's trying to sort of pave the way socially for the Saudi Aramco IPO. And even though the Aramco IPO has been delayed until next year, 2019, the crude oil price has hung in there because they've maintained this narrative. Whenever it looks like it's going to curl over, you see a headline out of Saudi Arabia that says, yeah, we're thinking $80 or $100 crude oil is more like the right price. And you look at the Cushing supplies and Cushing is absolutely getting drained. And you look at the fact that Saudi Arabia hasn't exported more than 1 million barrels of oil to the U.S. in any single week this year. And I just started adding those up on my yellow legal pad on the bullish side, and it's kept me in the crude oil trade. So the only other thing that I would add is that it got me to drill down into the refiners. And I jumped on Marathon Petroleum fairly early, and I was able to get into the stock because it started performing really well. It took out the 2015 highs at $60, and then all of a sudden there was this tidal wave of positive headlines for the refiners. You know, first there was that headline out of the International Maritime Organization where they're lowering sulfur emissions in all shippers and tankers to 0.5% from 3.5%. Right now, all that means is that they've got to have cleaner fuel emissions, you know, from the gasoline that they burn. Now, if you're a refiner that easily burns that sweeter gasoline with less sulfur emission in it, then you're in great shape. And that's where, you know, Marathon Petroleum and Phillips 66 really started getting juiced. And then we just had at the end of the at the end of April last month, Marathon Petroleum bought Andeavor, which we used to be which used to be Tesoro Refinery. So now we've got consolidation in that industry, and I'm still really excited about it, but I don't want to keep going talking. I'd love to hear what you have to say in return, but that's what I've been following in the crude oil market.
So you've been bullish, you remain bullish. And I think the one question I have is, how does this trade go wrong? Where does this trade all of a sudden get you out from buying dips, staying long, and potentially look at shorts?
Man, I'm not even close. I'm not there. You know, I still see that we are, you know, we've got synchronized global growth. The story is still alive, okay? It gets stronger and it falters and it gets stronger and it falters. But in general, I think that we are seeing global economic growth. In general, I think that as long as the Saudis have got this Aramco IPO on the calendar, that they are going to be in control and they are going to maintain the narrative and the pace of crude oil going higher. Because if they keep, you know, these production cuts, if they keep extending these production cuts, even through U.S. backing out of the Iran deal, I don't think that's going to be a major issue. You know, I guess if this whole narrative comes apart, if we start seeing drastic pullback in the U.S. And Chinese economies where, you know, where like you guys just spoke about, where we see the bond markets rally and we have this sort of period of a perceived economic weakness, I guess maybe the longs will pull the trigger and get out of crude oil. But, you know, I'm really focusing on the Saudi Aramco IPO, and I'm really focusing on everything that comes out of the headlines there, because they've been carrying the narrative and everything they seem to do turns out bullish crude oil. And then you get the you know, you get the inventory reports every week, and you have 5 million barrel draws, you know, and the shorts are all forced to cover again. So I'm just trying to play this from the long side. Technically speaking, I've got a target of about $85 in crude oil, and I'm not going to get bearish till we get there.
We're pretty much halfway through the year. I know we talked a lot of macro today, and you know me on the trading side, I always want to talk a little bit about execution. We'll start with you, Michael. What excites you the most for a trade opportunity in the second half of the year?
I'm going to keep a close eye on inflation-type trades, trying to take advantage of unexpected inflation. How that you could play that numerous ways, whether it's as we discussed, or if you're more sophisticated, you can do it with swaps, with inflation type swaps, break even swaps. But that's where I'm going to keep my eye out. And I haven't really done much in that area, but I think that's where I think most investors are offsides, thinking that inflation can happen here. And if the Fed continues on the path that they're on, I really think that inflation could be something that I'm not calling for hyperinflation, but it could be shocking inflation. And that could present some very nice opportunities.
Jesse, what's something that you're keeping an eye on for a potential trade between now and the end of the year?
You know, I've been really bullish on this inflation trade, and I've been very bullish on gold, but I have a longer term. I think it's a multi-year time frame, but it looks to me like gold could break out at any time. But more specifically, I think between now and the fall, I think we could potentially see a really good opportunity on the short side. I think we've seen there's so much. You look at the amount of money in leveraged long ETFs, the amount of margin debt that's been piled up in recent years. There's just a lot of euphoria that's literally been represented in positioning that I think that could potentially be unwound. You know, you're talking about the risk parity trade. I'm more specifically worried about the short volatility or volatility targeting funds, which specifically sell when volatility goes up. And I think, you know, they've probably, as volatility has been falling, you know, have leveraged back up again. But it's really, you know, I look at RIDEX traders too, and you know, the amount of assets in bullish leveraged bullish funds versus bearish funds is off the chart, higher than it was during the dot-com mania. So I think there's a potential a bunch of euphoria to be, you know, that's gone into leveraged investments on the long side that could potentially be unwound. And I think there's a window between now and the fall where that could be an opportunity, present an opportunity for people looking to trade on the short side.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.